It's Tuesday, March 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Pakistan increases anti-terrorism efforts while its neighbor accuses it of aiding the Taliban. A U.S. presidential hopeful wins big, but is it too little too late?
This kind of thing also plays into the nationalist sentiment. They're completely taken by it. They have no doubts about this whatsoever.
Western diplomats attend the trial of two journalists in Turkey. Ankara is not pleased. And a new exhibit opens about a living music legend. This and more on today's International Edition. Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has vowed to intensify counterterrorism operations in the wake of Sunday's deadly suicide bombing in the eastern city of Lahore targeting Christians. A military spokesman said Monday security agencies have conducted several operations based on initial leads and arrested a number of suspected terrorists and facilitators from areas in the provincial capital and two other cities of Punjab. That's the country's most populous province. Meanwhile, the Pakistani province of Punjab, the power base of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, is in the midst of 3 days of mourning after that suicide bomber killed or maimed hundreds of people, mostly women and children, at a park in the eastern city of Lahore. A Pakistani Taliban faction known as Jamaat-ul-Ahrar claimed responsibility for Sunday's attack that killed at least 70 people and wounded 300 others. A spokesman said the attack was aimed at Christians and more such attacks will occur. Regional analyst Alman Payand of Ohio State University tells VOA's Victor Beatty that this Pakistani Taliban faction has a history of attacking security forces as well as Western targets and religious minority groups.
This Taliban group are targeting not only the Christians, they're targeting Hindus. Some of Hindus are living in Pakistan, and also they are targeting the Shiites. So this is a group that has been condemned by the Pakistani government and all Muslim majority countries.
A spokesman for one of these groups said our suicide bombers will continue these attacks, I presume, against minorities, especially Christians.
I think the majority of the people that this group has targeted were the military officers and the military school. If you remember that about 14, 15 months ago, they targeted one of the schools that were the military officers. So their fight is with the Pakistani government and the Pakistani military. And it is a revenge that because the Pakistani government is bombarding the positions of this Pakistani Taliban in northwest frontier and also sometimes even inside the Afghan territory, Afghanistan. So there is a hot war going on between the Taliban and the Pakistani government, but they are just now attacking these other minority groups as well.
Well, this is the most horrific attack against civilians in Pakistan so far this year. The United States issued a statement saying it stands with the people and government of Pakistan at this difficult hour. We'll continue to work with our partners in Pakistan and across the region to root out the scourge of terrorism. What might that mean?
The United States is sharing intelligence, and there is a networking between the United States government and the European governments, and also all of these in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, and in Iraq, and other countries. So they are sharing this intelligence against these groups, which are really have become dangerous groups, all of them. Well, it used to be Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda is almost, this was after the Soviet Union invasion of Afghanistan. That invasion gave some sort of rise to the Al-Qaeda and Taliban, Afghan Taliban. And then the American troops going to Iraq, this ISIS, which was the Islamic State of Iraq, and then the Syrian Sunnis got together with the, it evolved in from ISIS to ISIL, which is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. So they are becoming a danger not only to outsiders, Europeans and Americans and Israel. So they are a danger against their own people.
Meanwhile, Afghanistan's spy chief is directly blaming neighboring Pakistan's military intelligence agency for being behind the Taliban's expanded insurgent activities in his country. Briefing lawmakers Monday in the lower house of the national parliament, Masood Andarabi, the acting head of the National Directorate of Security, warned that the Islamist insurgent group is determined to continue and intensify its violent campaign in the coming Afghan warmer months. He alleged Pakistan's military's inter-services intelligence, the ISI, is completely supporting the Taliban and encouraging them to continue the Afghan war and capture territory. Be sure to follow all of the developments on our website at voanews.com. CNNnews.com. In the race for the White House, Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders began this week on a very high note. He won caucuses for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination in three states Saturday, Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington, beating his rival Hillary Clinton by massive margins. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone is following the election campaign closely, and he tells International Edition host Michael Lippin how much of a boost Sanders might get from his latest victories.
Well, it's a much-needed boost for Bernie Sanders in this regard, that over the last few weeks, with some big Clinton victories in some of the larger states like Ohio and Florida, Sanders needed to show he was still relevant and needed to show that he could demonstrate he could stay in the race. And I think these victories, albeit in smaller voting electorates in these states, shows that Bernie Sanders and the appeal he has is very much alive in the Democratic Party. It's not going away. Now, what is his path to the nomination? Well, it's quite steep because he would have to win the remaining contest by quite a high figure in terms of percentages as Democrats allocate the delegates. But he's still relevant to the debate. And now I think the onus is a bit more on Hillary Clinton to somehow make the final closing case why Sanders has had a good campaign, but why he needs to close it out. His victories on Saturday, you know, kind of bought him more time, I think, to compete in some of the upcoming states, especially Wisconsin next week and beyond, say, New York and Pennsylvania.
Well, how do you think Bernie Sanders is going to do in those upcoming states?
Well, I think he's competitive, say, in Wisconsin, which votes on April 5th. He tends to do well in states that have a large proportion of progressive voters, liberal voters, among the Democrats who go to the polls. He tends to do well in states where the minority population is actually kind of lower. His core group is progressive whites, and he's done very well with younger people.
And why is it that minority Americans, blacks, Hispanics, are not so taken with his message as they are with Hillary Clinton?
I think there's a familiarity with Hillary Clinton that helps her a great deal based on her husband's presidency, the fact that they've been involved with civil rights groups for a few decades. It's not that Bernie Sanders hasn't supported those movements or those groups, but maybe he wasn't as visible as Bill and Hillary Clinton. So there's a longer kind of track record and link for those groups with the Clinton campaign, and she has really used it to her advantage, especially in those southern states with high African-American populations.
How concerned do you think Hillary Clinton's camp is about how Bernie Sanders has put together a series of primary and caucus wins now?
They want, the Clinton people, meaning they, want this to be over as soon as possible. Why? She thinks she is pretty much on track for the nomination. She wants to focus on the Republicans, particularly Donald Trump. The longer she has to contend with the challenge from Bernie Sanders and his energized followers, I mean, they're going to see it as a bit of a distraction. And she's got to be careful to not in any way disrespect what's going on there, because if she is to become the nominee, she's going to have to bound the whole party up and heal it together so they can have an effective campaign in the general campaign. So it's a very tricky balance here between realizing the kind of challenge Sanders presents and not antagonizing any of his followers.
VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone. Time now for our social media segment with G. Abby Lee, who joins me in the studio to tell us what's buzzing online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So I understand there are a couple of interesting hashtags out there.
Yes, there is a new hashtag on the Democratic presidential race. The latest one is hashtag tone down for what, and it's a wordplay on DJ Snake and Lil Jon's single from last year. How do I know this? Because I have that music, and I love it. That hashtag surfaced after Hillary Clinton's aide said her rival Bernie Sanders needs to change the tone of his campaign. Now, in an interview with CNN, her chief strategist, Joel Benenson, was asked about the possibility of the two contenders debating in New York. He answered, "Let's see the tone of the campaign he wants to run before we get any other questions."
So Sanders supporters are saying that there's no issue with the tone of his campaign, correct?
That's right. Sanders himself hasn't tweeted about it yet either.
I see. So what's the reaction to the gunfire near us on Monday?
Many people are closely following the Washington Metropolitan Police Department's Facebook page. That account wrote this Monday afternoon. There has been an isolated incident at the U.S. Capitol. There is no active threat to the public. A comment to the most number of likes reads like this. Great job. Thank you for keeping our Capitol safe. I wish people were checked before they enter the Capitol instead of while they enter. Not a very useful security strategy in the 21st century. It could backfire. Very dangerous. Also, the Wall Street Journal tweeted a correction. Apparently, no officer got hurt in the Capitol gunfire, contrary to initial reports.
Well, that's good to hear. Mm-hmm. But the Capitol wasn't the only area in the vicinity that had a security threat today, right?
Exactly. There was also a separate incident at the White House. But the lockdown was quickly lifted after the person who tried to jump over the fence was taken into custody. Under CNN's Facebook post about the incident, many people shared frustration with the mainstream media's coverage of it. Here's an example. Even though it's an isolated incident, expect CNN to devote a full day of coverage on this and link it back to terrorism in order to get higher ratings. So both incidents in D.C. on Monday appear to be pretty much isolated happenings, at least judging by social media reactions. Jim?
Well, no shortage of interesting things happening in Washington. Thanks for the analysis, G. You may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I also post there several times daily as well at VOA Stevenson. And we invite you to follow the International Edition stream. That's found at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. A rather curious thing is happening at the trial of two Turkish journalists, and it's upsetting Ankara. Senior diplomats from Turkey's Western allies, concerned about what they see as an erosion of human rights and democracy in the country, have been attending the trial. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul that Turkey's justice and foreign ministries are accusing the diplomats of interference in Turkey's judiciary.
Unacceptable, tweeted Turkish Justice Minister Bekir Bozdağ over the attendance of foreign diplomats at Friday's trial of journalists Can Dündar and Erdem Gül. Consul representatives from many of Turkey's key Western allies were in the courtroom. If convicted, the journalists face life imprisonment for articles accusing the government of arms smuggling to Syrian jihadists. The large turnout of senior diplomats was widely interpreted as a show of support for Dündar and Gül, whose trial has been strongly criticised internationally. The Turkish Foreign Ministry also expressed concern Monday and said it had made formal complaints. The criticism comes after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan strongly criticized his allies Saturday.
İstanbul'daki konsoloslar mahkemeye geliyor. Siz kimsiniz ya?
To the consuls general in Istanbul who attended the trial, he asked, "Who are you? What business do you have there? Diplomacy has a certain propriety and manners," he said, telling the diplomats, "This is not your country." Turkey's dominant pro-government media echoed those sentiments. One newspaper's headline read, "Crusader Unity for Journalists," while another said, "Invasion of the courtroom." Images and rhetoric of Western imperialism threatening Turkey play well with Erdogan's religious nationalist base, says political columnist Semih Diz of Turkey's Cumhuriyet newspaper and Al Monitor website.
I think it's mainly for his own supporters, you know, to drum up support for himself in Turkey. You know, he's still pushing for a constitutional change that will make him an executive president. And he is pandering to his constituents' populist sentiments. And this kind of thing also plays into the nationalist sentiment. They're completely taken by it. They have no doubts about this whatsoever.
The diplomatic spat comes amid already strained relations between Ankara and its Western allies over growing concerns for human rights and democracy. Turkey, which borders Syria and Iraq, remains a crucial ally in the fight against Islamic State and in stemming the flood of refugees into Europe. Columnist Idiz says the dispute will only add to already existing concerns about the president.
He is clearly not very popular in the West, and it's not doing much help to raise confidence in Turkey in the West. But they will maintain their attention and focus on Prime Minister Davutoglu, who, quite the contrary, is now going on about a new chapter in Turkish Western and Turkish EU relations. He even has repeated a number of times recently that Turkey is a European country and all that.
Ahmet Davutoglu is increasingly being presented in Western circles and by domestic critics of the president as a voice of reason in Ankara. But diplomatic tension is likely to add to that view, analysts point out. But they say the prime minister remains an isolated figure with Erdogan's iron grip on the ruling AK party and with most government ministers deferring to him. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
An experimental robot with a gentle touch is helping scientists unlock the mysteries of delicate marine life. Known as squishy fingers, the undersea machine can gently collect samples in deep water at depths way beyond the reach of human divers. VOA's Deborah Block talks about the issue with VOA's Susan Yockey.
Well, what's this all about?
Well, I really like this little robot. This robot can operate under the intense pressure that dramatically increases as it goes deeper into the sea. In fact, it's been tried out in more than 150 meters, which is very deep, to collect samples on the reefs. It has these supple grippers that kind of remind me of a moving caterpillar or the soft tentacles of a sea creature. And this device can take the fragile coral samples without breaking them or hurting the rest of the ecosystem. Another advantage is that this robot can get into these little burrows where some sea creatures live. Well, a team of researchers at the Wyss Institute of Harvard University, they've been developing two kinds of soft robotic grippers that are designed to pick up objects of different shapes and sizes. And what I thought was really interesting is the grippers were tested in a laboratory using different kinds of vegetables, believe it or not, like lettuce.
Well, what kind of information do the scientists hope to collect other than garden greens for a salad?
Yes, that's for sure. I think they're hoping for a whole lot more. Well, you know, the scientists control this robot from a boat, you know, using a joystick, so they can And so from there, they can actually see the samples it's collecting through a live video feed connected to the device. So, of course, they're hoping to get a close-up look at the specimens. They want to measure them, collect genetic data, and perhaps find some new sea creature, Susan, we have never seen before.
I like the name, but why squishy fingers?
I think there's a good reason for that. The grippers are mostly made from memory foam, which gives them their flexibility. Now, with this memory foam, when you squeeze it a little bit, you feel some pressure, but if you keep squeezing it, the pressure doesn't change. So this means the material won't be affected by the intense underwater pressure like a lot of other materials. But there are also plans to embed sensors on the grippers so the specimens do not have to be removed from the sea. And the scientists hope to add a tactile response to the grippers so that the person that's controlling the robot can actually feel what it's touching. Wouldn't that be amazing?
It would be amazing, especially if it touches something we've never seen before.
That's right.
I've seen pictures of when they brought up some samples from very deep in the ocean, and they come through the different pressures, and by the time they get to the boat, they're just mush. And this will help them see things that they can't see up here on the surface with the different atmospheric depths.
That's right. This is absolutely amazing.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Bob Dylan's influence on popular music crossed multiple genres. His impact on country music in particular is being celebrated in a new exhibit at the Country Music Hall of Fame called Dylan, Cash, and the Nashville Cats. Nikki Strong of VOA Music spoke with International Edition's Sarah Williams.
Nikki, tell us about Bob Dylan's role in country music.
Okay, well, before Bob Dylan went to Nashville to record, the place was really perceived as being conservative, a southern town, definitely not on the cutting edge of music. And that all changed when Bob Dylan bucked his record label and decided to record there. It opened doors for a slew of other prominent folk rock and pop artists at the time, such as Joan Baez and Paul McCartney and Neil Young, to also visit Nashville to record. And it helped foster a cultural exchange between all of those genres. And because of the high caliber of talent and skill and musicianship of the local session musicians that were there, which were called the Nashville Cats in this exhibit, so to speak, Nashville, or Music City, as they call it now, became a highly respected destination spot to make great music. And it is also this connection that helped make Dylan a major force in the creation of the country rock genre.
What brought Dylan to Nashville?
Okay, so this is the backstory. Dylan was recording with producer Bob Johnston in New York. And Bob Johnston used to live in Nashville, and he invited Charlie McCoy to come up to visit one of Dylan's sessions. And McCoy was a well-respected multi-instrumentalist session musician in Nashville. He came up and played guitar on Dylan's song, Desolation Row. Well, Dylan was so impressed with McCoy's musicianship, so Johnston was like, hey, Bob, there's more. You know where that came from. You should go down to Nashville to record. And so Dylan did. And in February 1966, he recorded what is considered one of his greatest albums, Blonde on Blonde.
We'll talk about his relationship with Johnny Cash.
Okay, so he and Johnny Cash, the two really bonded at the 1964 Newport Folk Festival. And they met up in Nashville in February of 1969. Dylan had recorded most of Nashville Skyline at that time when he went into the studio with Cash, and then they cut several duets. One is called Girl from the North Country, and that appeared on Nashville Skyline, and Cash wrote the Grammy-winning liner notes for the album. The exhibit in particular also focuses on how the Johnny Cash show also helped usher in a new era of country music by featuring artists of various genres as well, especially those of the country folk tradition. And Bob Dylan was one of its very first guests. Others include Linda Ronstadt and Joni Mitchell and Kris Kristofferson and Merle Haggard. The list goes on and on.
So Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats, that's the name of the exhibit. The Nashville Cats were the talented session musicians who helped bring the music of so many of these artists to life.
Exactly. So there's like 16 listening booths, and each is devoted to a Nashville Cat of the era. So it's like David Briggs, Kenny Buttrey, Fred Carter, Pig Robbins, just to name a few. Each booth provides biographical information, archival photos, audio samples of the musician's signature licks on both country and rock recordings from the late 1960s. And 70s. And there are all kinds of golden nuggets as well as part of the exhibit. Included, there's a manuscript in Dylan and Cash's handwriting for Wanted Man, a song that Dylan wrote for Cash in Nashville for Cash's 1969 album Johnny Cash at San Quentin. Paul McCartney's tape box for the master tapes and track sheets from his 1974 sessions in Nashville are there. There's a guitar and harmonica that Dylan used in the early 1960s. It's going to be a concert from the songs from the Blonde on Blonde album. There's guitar workshops, there's a bunch of fun stuff. And there's also a CD that you can actually purchase as part of the exhibit. You can buy it off Amazon. And the name of the CD is the same title of the exhibit. You can find out all kinds of stuff about the exhibit at countrymusichalloffame.org.
The exhibit is called Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats. It runs until December of 2016 at the Country Music's Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville, Tennessee. You can also hear all kinds of country music on VOA One's Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong. If you're on social media, you can reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music or on Twitter at VOA_music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
The guilty undertaker sighs, the lonesome organ grinder cries, the silver saxophones say I should refuse you. The cracked bells and washed out horns.
The hardest part of that is deciding which Dylan song to use. There's so many to choose from. You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at voanews.com. And please follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our engineer is Chaz Hall, director Tracy Carter. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks for being with us and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During the 31st regular session of the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, United States delegates raised concerns regarding human rights in Syria, Iran, Burundi, South Sudan, North Korea, and China. They also highlighted abuses in several other countries. The delegates congratulated the government of Burma for taking key steps in the direction of democracy, but noted concern about continued military influence over the parliament and key ministries, abuses and discrimination against ethnic and religious minorities, and continued legal restrictions on freedoms of speech, assembly, and association. The United States led a joint statement on freedom of expression and peaceful transitions within democracies. 66 countries supported the statement, welcoming actions taken by states undergoing transitions to protect freedom of expression. The United States also supported important resolutions on the need for the protection of human rights defenders and the freedom to peacefully protest. The Council defeated an unprecedented number of hostile amendments, 31, which aimed to weaken the resolution on human rights defenders. U.S. Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Theodore Allegra, highlighted abuses in Latin America. The Venezuelan government uses detentions to suppress and punish government critics, including the political opposition, civil society, and independent media, he said. We call for the release of political prisoners and justice for those tortured and mistreated in detention. He also called on Cuba to end the practice of arbitrary short-term detention, respect freedoms of expression and assembly, and release all political prisoners. Regarding Russia, Mr. Allegra said the U.S. remains concerned about the occupation of Crimea and Russia's actions in eastern Ukraine. Domestically, the Russian government increasingly restricts freedom of expression while creating a climate of impunity for harassment and attacks against activists, journalists, and the political opposition. The promotion of human rights remains a pillar of U.S. foreign policy. The fight for greater freedom, greater respect, greater dignity is a unifying narrative of our humanity in all its diversity, Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken said recently. That is why we are very proud to join this council in upholding our common responsibility to this universal pursuit. The United Nations Human Rights Council celebrated its 10th anniversary this month. The United States' commitment to the mandate and mission of the Council runs deep into our nation's history, Deputy Secretary of State Blinken said in an address to the high-level segment. It is engraved into our nation's founding values and etched into the standards we strive to hold ourselves to every day.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's for